Hello, idea circulators. This is Thomas Malik, your guest host for Circulating Ideas. Today, I'm going to have a conversation with the King of the North, Matthew Murray. How's it going, Matthew?
It's going all right. I think it's really funny that you called me that because since I now live in the USA, not so northernly.
Which part of the USA?
I am currently living in Las Vegas, Nevada, and I work as a librarian at the University of Nevada, Las Vegas.
Well, as an academic librarian, you're still farther north than a lowly South Carolinian public librarian. So,
I wouldn't know. My knowledge of American geography is very poor.
Okay. For all I know, we're on the same latitude line, but...
And Las Vegas is pretty far south, actually. It gets really hot here in the summer. It was like, and bear with me because I don't actually understand what these numbers mean. It was 117 last summer while we were here. So yeah, to the non-Americans, that is 47 Celsius.
Did you just whip out Celsius on me?
I am Canadian. What? That's the number. That's Celsius is what I understand.
117 means your eyeballs change color when you go outside.
Yeah, you try not to go outside at all in that scenario.
Yeah, ALA Las Vegas taught me that once.
Yes.
I just feel like I'm burning at all times out here.
Yeah, it doesn't really get any colder at nighttime. And it just kind of goes from like May to August, like the same heat every day. It's weird. Not the sort of temperature I'm used to, but I lived in Southeast Asia for a year, so like the high temperatures weren't as foreign to me as some people coming from Canada might have felt.
Now, what was that transfer like from Canada to America? How was that was that planned, or is that just where the most opportunity was found?
So I think one thing that a surprising number of Americans don't realize is the population difference between the USA and Canada. So there are 10 times the number of people in the USA as there are in Canada. There are more people in just California than in all of Canada. So when you're looking for jobs in the library world, or I guess really any field, you're going to find more job postings in America than the ones that you find than in Canada, just because of the number of people that are there. So I was looking for jobs, and I was looking for some in Canada, and I applied for some in Canada, but I was also looking for ones in America because I guess it is right there, and I was willing to try living in the USA for a while. And this was the job that hired me, so that's why I moved down here.
Well, we're glad to have you, and it's not just population numbers. We lovers of the Fahrenheit system enjoy our triple digit temperatures.
Yeah, occasionally people like say things like, I can understand that 117 is very hot, but you know, once you start saying things like 80 or 70, and that just doesn't mean anything to me.
Although our freezing point is 32, so it's a little nonsensical. Yeah. Well, you came down from Canada, but I'm aware that before you moved down here, and still today, you're distributing a lot of zines.
Yeah, I've been involved with doing zine stuff for, I guess, a really long time now. Probably over a decade, at least, involved with zines in one way or another, like making them and organizing events and doing lots of stuff like that. And I have been really excited that I've been able to do some of that work as well with zines in the library world. And so I help organize the Zine Pavilion at the American Library Association annual conference every year, which is a great time. We have a space on the trade show floor, and we have a bunch of local zinesters come in to the event, and we have basically just a little mini zine fest. And I realize that some people listening might not know what a zine is, so I'm going to explain it first. That's probably the first thing I should have done anyway. So zine is spelled Z-I-N-E, or... for Americans, I suppose, Z-I-N-E. And they are, I think the way I tend to describe them is small self-published magazines. Though, you know, that it usually means like the print run is pretty limited. People make them on photocopiers or their printers at their home, and they frequently, you know, just give them away or sell them really cheaply. And they can be about any topic you can possibly imagine. And so you have ones that are have recipes, ones that are about travel stories, ones that are about health related things, comics, poetry. My mind is music. So there's all sorts of topics, politics, everything is in them. And more libraries are starting to collect them, which I think is really awesome. Because one of the reasons I think it's so important for libraries to collect zines, and one of the reasons I think zines are so important, is because they help give a voice to the voiceless. They're frequently made by marginalized communities whose voices are not seen in the mainstream media. And whether that means people of color or even like teenagers, in just teenagers in general, that can mean that, you know, those voices are not, when it's their personal voice talking about their own lives and their experiences, that's not something you really get to see in the mainstream media that often. So getting back to the Zine Pavilion, every year at the American Library Association Conference, we have a space in the trade show floor. We have zinesters, which is the name for people that make zines, come in, and we have a zine fair. And a zine fair is like, it's like a comic book convention, I guess, except just for zines. And so we have a little mini one. We have tables set up, and they're selling their wares, their zines, to people that come by, and talking to a lot of people and explaining what zines are. We run some workshops. We talk about things like cataloging zines, running zine making workshops, that sort of thing. And I think one of the reasons that I like zines so much, in addition to what I said earlier, is the low barrier to entry. Writing a book or making a movie or something can take a lot of time and in some cases cost a lot of money. But making a zine is something that you can do pretty easily and and cheaply, which is great. And it is awesome to see people inspired by making these things, but inspired by seeing other people making them and wanting to make their own, which is something that always makes me really excited and happy, because I love doing things that inspire creativity in others, and having people realize that they can make something as well, and they don't just have to consume media.
After you've introduced people to the zine culture, mm-hmm. and then when you've helped them make a zine, what goes into the distribution of the zine and making sure that it gets eyeballs?
So the way that zines are distributed is you can get them at, and this is also how zines are collected by libraries, and you know, building a collection can be a challenge for something that you can't get through the traditional, you know, library suppliers. And so zines are for sale at zine fairs, like I said. You can get them from, buy them directly from people. A lot of people have things like Etsy stores or stores on Big Cartel or other web platforms. And then there are people that have distro set up as well. And distro, which is a I guess distribution, is somebody that has zines from a bunch of different people. So they collect a lot of different zines from, you know, focusing on a certain topic. So maybe they're all feminist zines, or maybe they're all zines by people of color, or maybe they're all music zines or anything like that. And so they get all these zines together. And so you can then order directly from them. And so instead of ordering from five different people, you order from one person who can send you five different people's zines. And these people might also set up at music shows and other events, or go to zine fairs themselves. The other way that I think can be good to acquire zines, especially for a library, is to host zine making events yourself. And so if you have a zine making event, you can invite people to donate a copy of the zine to the library, or just having, you know, zine donation boxes or something if you're tabling at events as well at zine fairs. There's a lot of like trading zines through the mail and stuff like that. And there's a lot of different places online where you can find people that want to trade zines or anything like that. There are Facebook groups. There are people on Twitter. There are, you know, social media sites. There's a, what's it called? What's that thing that everybody uses for like gaming chat and stuff now?
Twitch?
No, it's
Discord.
Discord. Yeah, somebody just started a Zine Discord server/channel thing. So that exists. For those that are interested in finding out more about Zine Librarian stuff or zines in general, I would recommend looking at the Zine Pavilion Tumblr, which is zinepavilion.tumblr.com, the Zine Librarians Facebook group, which is a group that I created and currently has over 400 members, which is very exciting to me. And you should just be able to search for that. And there's also a Zine Librarian website, which is at zinelibraries.info, and there's a mailing list as well. And one thing that's really kind of interesting about some of these online groups is that they have people that are not librarians in that they have an MLIS or, you know, an MIS or an MLS or whatever. They don't have the masters. And they kind of, they run zine libraries in other spaces. And so there are zine libraries all over the world, and they might be in a coffee shop or a social center or, I don't know, it's just somebody's bedroom or something, you know? And so there are people that create these zine libraries, and, you know, they can have catalogs and borrowing privileges and everything else, but the people running them are just people that have other jobs. And this is the only aspect of librarianship that they're really involved with. And it's really cool to see, to get these outside perspectives, not just having library folk involved with it, I think. And every year there is a Zine Librarian Unconference that happens somewhere that gathers people, both, you know, people that work in libraries and people that don't work in libraries but are really into zines, and they come together, and we have, there's, you know, great discussions and everything that happen. The one this year is in, where is it happening? It's in Minneapolis. The Zine Librarian Unconference 2018 is in Minneapolis. So that's going to be cool. I don't know if I'm going to get a chance to go to it. I think it's happening this summer sometime. I'm not sure the exact date. I did get to go to the one last year in Long Beach, which was a lot of fun.
Well, among all of these zines, Matthew, you have a zine that you are especially focused on that you put out. Yeah. And you take submissions.
Yes. So I make a fiction anthology zine, which is the 9th issue, will be coming out soon-ish. It is called, the overarching title is Two-Fisted Library Stories. So it is, perhaps as you can tell, kind of genre fiction-y, so science fiction and fantasy and that sort of thing. So you have, there's just fiction stories, short stories, there's comics, there's horoscopes in some of them, there's weird fan letters that don't exist. I've read a lot of comic books and things like that, and so I really enjoy making things that are like old comics in some ways. So you have, you know, fake interviews with creators that don't exist for books that don't exist. You have a list of all of the other titles that the fictional publisher of Two-Fisted Library Stories puts out. So, you know, there's the Jungle Librarians and the Action Librarians and Hypatia Lord Library Scientist and all these other titles that really only exist in my mind. And there's a billion super weird in-jokes that nobody other than me will ever get as well. So these have an open call for submissions. I put out about 2 issues a year, and sometimes they're themed and sometimes they're not themed. And anybody is welcome to submit something. You can read the first 6 issues online. So if you go to twofistedstories.blogspot.com, you can go to there's a back issues link there, I think, and that will show you how to find the first 6 issues on Issue, which is a website that for like magazines and stuff. So you can go look at the issues there and see what sort of content there is. And it's been really awesome to see people write me weird stories, just because I had this kind of ridiculous idea of like, oh yeah, what if there was, you know, a fiction anthology zine with stories about post-apocalyptic librarians or crime noir librarians or library workers or anything like that. So it's a lot of fun, and it's pretty goofy at the same time, I think. The last issue that came out last year was Two-Fisted Library Studies. So it was pretty different in that it was a fake, sort of a satirical academic journal about libraries. So there were articles, and there were a lot of graphs in it. More graphs and tables than any other zine you've seen. But that was a lot of fun to put together. And I had a bunch of contributions from different people, and it's really awesome. To me, it's really awesome to see that people are like inspired to create something for it. And at the same time, it has inspired me to like draw covers and things. And I don't think I ever would have done that without this zine. So if anyone is interested in reading it or indeed creating something for it, you should go and check out the website. And you can send me a message or something through that, or on Twitter or Facebook or anywhere else that you see me.
If you're not careful, you could bring up a fantasy or sci-fi premise for libraries and Matthew will find you and suggest it as a story premise.
That does happen on Twitter sometimes as well. People just make offhanded tweets and I'm like, oh, you could turn that into a story. I don't think anyone's actually taken me up on it yet, but perhaps one day that will happen.
Speaking of things you put together that librarians can rally around, I had the honor of interacting with your Radbot, Raspberry Pi powered machine where you just push a button and a randomly generated reader's advisory slip of paper comes out, describes a book to you.
That was a really fun idea that I did while I was still getting my master's. And so I saw this picture on Tumblr of I don't even remember what it was. It was like an Arduino connected to this printer, and I think it printed poems or something. And I was like, oh, hey, I bet I could do this and, you know, do it better, because of course that's what I thought, but do one that printed out book recommendations. And so I got together with, the student group of ASSIST, the Association of Information Science and Technology, and found some people with that group that were like also excited about making this thing and learning more about Raspberry Pis and coding and all that sort of stuff, which was awesome. And we put together, we called it the RAD, the Reader's Advisory Device. And we went to the Vancouver Mini Maker Fair and exhibited at that with it for several years. They continued going to it after the year I graduated as well. So I wasn't even involved and they were still going, which was made me so excited that I had inspired people I didn't even know to continue doing maker stuff. And the second year, Thomas, we made the machine better, actually. So you saw the one that just had one button, right?
Right.
Yeah. So the problem we encountered the first year at the Maker Faire was that children really loved coming up and pushing the button. And we had not anticipated this because I guess we just, for whatever reason, didn't think of it. So our list of book recommendations. So I'll say when you pushed the button, it randomly picked a book recommendation from a list of 100 that we had all, you know, created and chosen ourselves. So this list was not child friendly. I think there were about three titles in there that were appropriate for children. And there were other titles that where even the title was not appropriate for children. And so we had to vet every book recommendation that came out and be like, okay, child, you cannot have Bastard Out of Carolina. Your parents might get upset at us for that book recommendation. So the second year, what we did was we added a second button. And so then there was one button for children and one button for adults, and we had two separate lists. And so that worked a lot better.
Did you have a no children sign put up?
No, I don't think we thought we didn't think that far ahead the first year. But if
you didn't electrify the button.
No, we didn't do that either. I think that probably would have gotten us kicked out of the Maker Faire, to be honest.
Okay.
We gave a poster presentation about our experience creating this at the Association for Information Science and Technology conference a few years ago as well. So that was really exciting. And that was, so it's kind of funny that this picture on Tumblr I saw of something, and I don't know if it was, maybe it was a book recommendation machine or a poetry machine, led to an actual academic poster that was published. And I'll send you the link or something so that, you know, if there's show notes, they can be linked from there.
There's that saying about good artists borrow, great artists steal.
Yes.
You can say, well, good libraries borrow, great libraries make a conference presentation.
Yeah, I think
about the thing they borrowed.
Yes, that's perfect. And I know that some other people have, I believe, made their own like book recommendation machines after seeing the one that I helped create. And so that was really exciting too. And I think if you go to the student website, I think all the code and stuff is there so that you can download it and you don't have to go through the process of doing that yourself. I think we put it all up on GitHub, but I could be wrong.
You referenced a lot of groups, yes, so far. And I understand you have a strong interest in scholarly communication.
Yeah, my current job is in the Scholarly Communication Initiatives Department.
The initiatives? Are you starting the initiatives or executing them?
Both, perhaps. I don't know. I'm not in charge of the department by any way. My official title is Visiting Library Fellow, because my position is a 2-year fellowship for early career librarians. This leads to a lot of people seeing my name badge or my business card and asking where I'm visiting from. And I have to tell them that I'm not visiting from anywhere because it's not like I have another job to go back to after this one's over.
Well, I look at my badge at ALA and until I get a whole rainbow of ribbons, mine just says schlub. But you're a library fellow.
It's a really...
That sounds so honorable.
I guess so, but at the same time, it just seems really strange. It's a weird job title to have, I think. So yeah, there's a number of different places around that offer similar programs to the library fellows that to the University of Nevada, Las Vegas. I'm one of the first two that the university has done in this position. So there have been some growing pains for sure. There have been I think at times they didn't really know what to do with us. We have gotten to work on some cool projects. So I've done stuff with ORCID identifiers, which are the Open Researcher and Contributor IDs. And so we worked with the ORCID API to try and work with an integration, to set up an integration so that we could be updating UNLV faculty members' profiles with their publications as they came out. And that didn't really go according to plan, which is unfortunate. But we did get release a white paper report showing all of the problems we went through and how we solved those problems or solved some of them. And we did, as you just said, Thomas, we are presenting about it later this year as well. So at the Digital Initiative Symposium in San Diego, I and my colleague A.L. Carson will be presenting about our ORCID experiences there, which is kind of neat. And we're also submitting things to a few other conferences. So perhaps you will see us around. And if you do see us at a conference, or see me at a conference and are interested in this, and even if I'm not presenting, feel free to ask me any questions about this. I am fairly recognizable within the library world, as I'm sure you know, Thomas.
Whatever do you mean, Matthew?
I have a kind of silly haircut that is generally dyed an unnatural color. So it is currently pinkish-reddish color, and it's been that way for a few years now. And I only wear black clothing and I have a facial piercing. So I'm not exactly what most people, and there's a lot of library world. I kind of stand out a little bit. If you see somebody that looks like that at a library conference, it might very well be me.
Now in the library world, this might set you apart, but in the mutant counterculture, this bears a whole different resemblance that people would recognize. Is that right?
I suppose so. So Thomas is referencing to a specific character in the X-Men comic books called Quentin Quire / Kid Omega, who is a teenage mutant who is on the X-Men kind of at times. He's kind of a jerk. Sometimes, a lot of the time, perhaps, is the best way to put it. You know what's funny, Thomas? So I actually got this haircut and even the hair color before I realized that the character looked like that. It was not intentional. So, but I have, I, it is a character that I enjoy, and I've enjoyed, I enjoyed the Wolverine and the X-Men run by Jason Aaron and various artists that featured the character fairly prominently. And so I did, I have done cosplay as Quentin Quire at a couple of comic book events. And so I think at Emerald City Comic Con and San Diego Comic Con, at both events, I have dressed up as this character. And I'm always a little disappointed that more people don't recognize me, but at the same time, it is a fairly obscure character, in a lot of ways. But yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Well, when you mentioned going to conferences around America, I was going to make a reference to, you might also see Matthew at a different kind of conference across America.
Yeah. So why was I at Emerald City Comic Con and San Diego Comic Con, apart from being a gigantic nerd? And the reason is that at last year, at least at both events, I was helping to organize some library specific programming that was happening at them, which was super exciting. And so at Emerald City, it was the first time that it had happened. And I helped get together a group of a whole bunch of library folks from a bunch of library systems. I can't remember how many different library systems there were, but they came from all over Washington, the Washington area. Some came down from Vancouver as well. And we had a number of different panels about things like running your own comic convention in your library, doing comic book related library programming. And we also had a pop-up library space on the show floor, which was super fun. And so I didn't help up that much with that, because to be fair, I am an academic librarian, and the people that you really want staffing your pop-up library in a at a comic book convention are the public librarians who interact with the public every day and are really good at like giving recommendations and helping people out. Whereas I sit in a back room and write really long reports about APIs. So I may not be the best person to have as your public facing. But I know that this year, again, they are doing stuff at Emerald City Comic Con. This year they have, it's happening at the Seattle Central Library, which is cool. Last year we had the events happening at the convention center itself, but there's a whole bunch of different events happening on Thursday, March 1st, at the Seattle Public Library as part of Emerald City Comic Con, and they have sessions on what are some of the stuff here? Building a more diverse comics collection, LGBTQ graphic novels. They have some publishers coming in and stuff like that, doing a great graphic novel program at your library. And I think they also have the pop-up library space happening again, which is neat. The other event, and so I really have to also give a shout out to Claire Scott at Seattle Public Library, who's really helped organize that this year. The other event that I've helped do is at San Diego Comic-Con. And this is the Comics Conference for Educators and Librarians, which happens at Seattle Public Library. No, sorry, that happens at San Diego Public Library in San Diego, and is helped to be coordinated by Erwin Magbanua. And I've just mispronounced his last name, so I'm very sorry, Erwin. But he works at San Diego Public Library. And so that is another event where they have a whole bunch of sessions with library folk and educating folk and publishers and comic book creators giving sessions at the public library about comics. And it's super fun to have. They're doing it again this year. They're just calling. I just saw a call for people that are interested in participating this year. And so I'm really excited to see that it's continuing, and that there's more and more library presences at comic book events, which I think is really exciting, because it kind of takes two of my things I really enjoy and puts them next to each other. I never thought that, like, when I was applying to library school, I did not think that my knowledge of comics or zines or games or any of that stuff would be seen as a benefit in the library world, but it really has turned out to be, which has been a pleasant surprise.
Would you be willing to comment on it strikes me in your description of these programs and your role promoting zines and comics to an extent. Can you comment on the inclusivity of these communities, especially as it pertains to libraries? Comics conferences, they used to be very vendor focused, and this is a place that they'd be places where the true collectors can, you know, stash some more product in their vaults. But I feel like they've opened up more to families and to the wider cosplay community, and that something that, well, I'm just going to be blunt. There's a toxic kind of comics fan out there who likes to characterize everything as, well, this is a business and I'm a customer and that's all that matters in comics as an industry. But I feel like libraries entering the convention sphere are able to help reinforce, no, we can open this door to everybody and we can make sure that everyone has a voice and that publishers make sure to diversify their product, make sure it reflects the world around them and not just the loud mouths or the people who say, well, I was here first. And so no one else, everyone else has to get in after me.
That's one of the things that I have really enjoyed about some of the recent comic book conventions that I've attended is that you go to like the artist alley section, which can be much larger than an alley. So just the comic book creator sections, and you have such a diverse group of people, so much more diverse than it has been in the past. Even like as recent as 10 years ago, it's gotten so much better in like the last decade. So you have far more women involved. You have far more people of color. You have far more queer people. You have just a lot more diversity. It's not just, you know, straight white men drawing sexy pinups. And they are still there, but there's a lot more diversity in the people making comics and the types of comics that are getting made. So you find, you know, not just superhero comics, but romance comics and supernatural comics and crime comics and comics about relationships and queer anthologies and comics for kids and all sorts of stuff. And so I think the comic book industry has really gotten to a point where there is something for everybody, which is amazing. And it can be hard to find that thing for a specific person at times, especially because there are still a fair number of comic book shops that don't have the best selection and don't stock everything in their store. And so if you walk into just a random comic book shop, you might not find something that you're interested in, but that could be because it's just not in that shop. And it's so that can be frustrating at times. And some of the business decisions made by some of the major superhero comic publishers are highly questionable at times, I will say, is possibly the most polite way I can put it. But they can also put out really high quality titles as well at times.
When they feel like it.
Yeah. Or even when they don't feel like it and it happens by accident. It's kind of funny because like you talk about, you know, like the old school fan who wants to just, you know, get old comics or something. And to some extent that is me. I don't care about the value of comics. I definitely don't own anything that's worth money, but I do really enjoy digging through old comic books and buying like comics from the 80s and 90s and everything that I've never heard of before. Or ones that I have heard of before that I'm trying to find specific issues of, and reading those as well. And, not necessarily, something that I can recommend that everybody else do. I'm currently reading, for example, I am reading along with a podcast called Baxter Building that is doing a read-through of every Fantastic Four comic ever. So they started this 3 years ago. There's one episode a month, and I've been reading along with most of it through collections and back issues and stuff like that. And I've read a lot of really bad Fantastic Four comics. I don't even like the Fantastic Four that much, which is really kind of funny. I like the hosts, and I think it's kind of entertaining to read along with them. And we're up to, I think, 1989 now with the Fantastic Four. So we're getting into the, close to the era when I started reading comics and they got really, really bad for a while in the 90s, the superhero comics.
Did you say this helped or harmed your health?
I'm not going to say either way, I guess. One of the things is, I guess, is reading these comics that are from a previous time period. You do kind of have to be aware a little bit about that they're not from today and what the market was. And that doesn't excuse some of the content, but it does explain it. Does that make sense?
Yes. And I do feel like I should add extra context to my miniature rant that I have nothing against older eras of comics or older collectors, but just that special breed of collector who don't seem to want to spread the joy that they get out of comics. They just want to hoard the joy from everyone else.
Yeah, there is definitely, I think, there can definitely be a problem with the quote-unquote gatekeepers within the comics world and within, you know, the gaming world as well. And people that don't like people liking things that they don't like, or don't like people liking things in a different way. And so that can be very frustrating to see and experience in online discussions. Yeah.
Let's talk about your role regarding comics and libraries as one of the editors for No Flying, No Tights. Now, sure. What do you do there?
So No Flying, No Tights is a comic book review site that was started by Robin Brenner quite a few years ago now. I'm not exactly sure how long it's been around, but they started it and it is aimed at librarians and library staff and probably educators and teachers and stuff too. And all of the writers are people that work in libraries, all the reviewers. And so I have volunteered as an editor for the site for the last several years. And I have been editing, I edit special features. So when there's things like occasionally they do creator interviews, or when we do lists of if you liked title X, maybe you'll like title Y, or themed ones. So like we've done lists of, I think we did an LGBTQ queer comics list and some other things I can't remember. Things like, oh, hey, the Wonder Woman is out. Here are a bunch of good Wonder Woman comics, that sort of thing. And I also copy edit the teen reviews right now, which is sometimes where I see your reviews, Thomas.
And No Flying, No Tights did start in 2002 as part of Robin Brenner's class project. Has been running for 16 years, and you can find her interview on Circulating Ideas on episode 66, where they murder all the Jedi.
You had that knowledge, like you had that information just ready to say, didn't you?
I don't know if the mic picked up me Googling that on the spot or not.
Fair enough. I think it's a a good site for people that might not have a lot of comic book knowledge, because the reviews do try to discuss why a title might be one that you would want in your library, in your collection, and also talks about age ratings as well. We try to make an effort to talk about if the age rating supplied by the publisher is appropriate, if they supply one, or what the appropriate age rating might be, and also why that rating is there. Because and so we talk about things like, you know, if the age rating is there because of the language or because of violence or because of sexual situations and things like that. And that's something that a lot of reviews don't include, I think. And so especially for comics, most people that are writing comic reviews don't think of that stuff. And it's very easy to become kind of immune to a lot of the tropes that exist in comics and not necessarily pay attention to them sometimes. And so I think our reviewers tend to do a pretty good job of picking out why certain things are are potentially appropriate or inappropriate for collections. It's a topic that is really tough to quantify sometimes. And I think here's a thing that I cannot confirm yet, but I'm hoping that at the American Library Association conference this summer, we're discussing right now having a session about ratings and things like that, and how to decide if something is appropriate for your collection or not, and talking about things such as fan service in manga and, you know, sexualization of characters in superhero comics. And I say sexualization of characters, but what I really mean is sexualization of women characters.
Some years ago, there were some librarians going after like Story Snoops and Common Sense Media for having different ratings and ways to quantify the contents of different books. But like, you see a lot of parents and educators come through the library, and they'll often be upfront about, look, I don't mind that the library carries books that has these things in it. I just want to know in advance before I hand it to a very young person who thinks that the cover looks nice.
I honestly really have to agree with that. I think you have, especially for people in public libraries or in school libraries, they have to be, you know, aware of what material that they have and what material is being borrowed. And I occasionally find material in a specific collection that I think is inappropriate for that collection. And it goes both ways. I think, this probably shouldn't be here because it might be, you know, have contained material that is inappropriate. But also, B, the people, like, if you find a Vertigo comic, which is a mature reader's published imprint of DC Comics, who publish things like Sandman and Why the Last Man and Fables, if you find one of their comics in the children's section, it probably shouldn't be there because it's going to have things that are perhaps could be considered inappropriate for children. But B, people that will want to read it won't find it. Which is, I think, is also a really important aspect of that, is putting material where people will find it is really key. The one that bothers me the most that I see quite frequently in libraries is Tintin in the Congo by Hergé, shelved in the children's section. Are you familiar with that comic, Thomas?
I am giving a woeful nod on this end.
So Tintin, which I guess a lot of people at least probably know from the movie now, is a Franco-Belgian comic created originally in the early 20th century, and that came out sporadically for several decades, and is considered one of the kind of masterpieces of European comics. Hergé worked with a studio and was very meticulous in creating the comics and drew and redrew series over the years. But Tintin in the Congo is really racist, is what it comes down to. Spectacularly so. And it was not even translated into English for a long time because of this. And the Tintin comics are seen as being for children. And I think most of them are fairly fine for that. I read them as a child, though I guess I read them as a child in the 1980s and 1990s. But Tintin in the Congo is the one where I'm just like, I don't think you can just let children see that sort of material without an explanation for it. And I will never say I think libraries should have it, but putting it next to the other Tintin books and next to the children's books, I think is not necessarily the best idea that I've ever seen people have.
What are some great comics that you've seen either personally or on the No Flying, No Tights site, just as an editor, that you would recommend people put on the shelves?
So starting with children, I'll really try to limit myself because I could be here all day. Luke Pearson's Hilda comics are published by Nobrow. I think there's five of them so far, and they are amazingly adorable, beautifully illustrated comics about a little girl and her adventures with like weird spirits and stuff like that. They are super cute. As I said, the art is just beautiful, and I really want, I think more people should read them. I think it's getting turned into like a Netflix cartoon or something, so soon everybody will know what it is.
I was starting to get the feeling that, like, between me attacking the fans and you calling out Tintin, I'm like, okay, we got to endorse something here.
I love the Tintin comics. I'm a massive Tintin fan. I think that Hergé was an amazing artist. I went to the Hergé Museum when I was in Belgium. Like, I went to Belgium so I could go to the Hergé Museum. That's how big a fan I was. So a couple of other titles that I will mention is Giant Days by John Allison and Max Sarin.
Yes.
And this is a monthly title that comes out from Boom. And John Allison is also the writer of Bad Machinery, which I think has been on the Yalsa top 10 graphic novels list before, and Scary Go Round, his webcomic. And Giant Days is about three young ladies who have gone off to university, and they are quite different, and they become best friends, and they have, like, weird adventures. And John Allison has been writing comics, webcomics and stuff, since the 90s. And he is so good at it. His dialogue is amazing. His plotting is great. He's really also really good at, like, kind of telling a satisfying single issue, I think, which not everybody is good at now. And so I decided that was my favorite comic of last year, because it's just super, super good. And I will also mention Monstrous by Marjorie Liu and Sana Takeda, which is a insanely epic and beautiful fantasy comic. There's two volumes out now from Image, and it is amazing. It is kind of Asian influenced fantasy by two Asian women that is brutal. It is not a very happy world that is there, but the world is incredibly there's so much history, there's so much culture, there's so much things that have happened in the world, and it's really an amazing series, I think, and the art is just wonderful. And I don't want to go on and on with comics, so I think I'll just stop with those three. If you want to hear more about comics that I like, though, you can go and check out the Best of 2017 episode of my podcast, The Book Club for Masochists, which is a reader's advisory podcast with several other library folks. And we put out two episodes a month, and one episode is a genre, which we choose at random, which is why it is called The Book Club for Masochists, because we read books that we do not enjoy a lot of the time. Kind of force our ways through so that we can say, yes, I have read a legal thriller and maybe this is why people like it, or read a historical romance, or read a gardening book and things like that. And then the other episodes are about various topics. And so the one that came out a few weeks ago or in early January was our Best of 2017. And I talk about Giant Days and a bunch of other titles that I really enjoyed that I read in 2017. And also, my hosts give a bunch of recommendations for things that aren't comics. I also give some of those as well.
Moving on from comics, let's talk about your fellowship. You said it was a 2-year appointment. Is that right?
Yes, it's a 2-year position.
What are your professional goals once your time's up?
So my professional goal is to go back to Canada. Being in America at this moment in time, and in Las Vegas at this moment in time, have kind of indicated to me, kind of highlighted a lot of the differences between the USA and Canada, and made me want to go back to the country that I consider my home. So yeah, that's the goal. As for professional goals, I have a lot of stuff that I want to do. I'm so excited about there are so many possibilities for things that I would love to see more of. And some of it's stuff I'm working on that I hope to develop further in the future. And so it's things like integrating like meaningful gaming into the education systems. And so using aspects of gaming to help people learn about certain things. And so one of the projects I'm working on right now, and who knows if anything will come of this, but I'm working with some of my colleagues at work about this, and is an escape room about research data management, which sounds like the nerdiest possible thing that you could ever consider. But one of my areas that I work with is research data management, and thinking about how we can educate both students and faculty about good research data management practices. And so thinking about ways that you can communicate that sort of information in an entertaining and informative way that hopefully they'll remember. I think there's the potential for things like escape rooms to be used there. Other stuff that I want to do with my professional career, you know, something that I really kind of just realized relatively recently is that I don't have to do everything now.
Can you repeat that?
I don't have to do everything right now.
Because you got a lot of projects on your plate, young man.
I do. And I really like working on projects and doing things. But the realization that I can say no to things because my intention is to be in the library world for a long time, for like the next several decades. And so I'm like, oh, if I don't get to that now, you know, maybe, you know, next year or 2 years or 5 years from now, I'll still be working in a library. I don't know where, but somewhere. And maybe then I can use that idea or work on that idea. And that's something that's kind of strange to me, is having that like long-term possibilities in an area, but is exciting. And it's kind of, it's important. I think it's incredibly important for people working in libraries and for students and for people that in every field, is the ability to say no to things. Because some people feel that they have to say yes to everything that they're asked to do. And I think that just leads to people being incredibly overwhelmed and not necessarily doing as good a job as they could otherwise. And being able to say no is, I think, a really crucial part of being a professional and knowing what your limits are and knowing that you need to have time for yourself and that you shouldn't just be working on, you know, work and committees and writing things for publication all the time. You have to have other time that is not for those things. So I'm maybe not always the best example of that because I do tend to do a bunch of stuff, but at the same time, I like play video games and stuff too. And that's, you know, no one is going to hire me for their library because I've like got 100% in Far Cry 4.
Are you using the American name of that game, or does it have some different Canadian title and you're simply placating me?
No, it's just called, I don't know. Maybe there could be a French title for release in Quebec. I really miss living in America. I really miss the bilingual food packaging that exists in Canada. So in Canada, every food product you purchase in packages has French and English ingredients and all of the other text on the package. If you, you know, are on a flight, all the safety announcements are in English and French. And my partner and I flew back up to Vancouver last month to visit some friends, and because I had to renew my work permit, because I had to leave the country to do that. And on the flight up, you know, they did all the announcements in French and English, and I'm just like, I'm going home to the country where they speak French, which is a language I don't really understand very well.
You're pretty active on social media, and I wanted to ask, are there any librarians or just cool folks in general who you follow that either you enjoy consuming whatever content they're putting out, or enjoy the conversations that they build?
Yes.
Besides Steve Thomas's acclaimed podcast, Circulating Ideas.
Yes.
Which is sometimes co-opted by the fantastic Secret Stacks.
I'm not going to name any names because I am really bad at remembering that, and I'm like, oh, was that person's name or just their handle or what was it? But I think that Twitter has been a really neat, like, good way for me to interact with other library professionals, learn about things in my area. So I follow a lot of people that are involved with scholarly communications. And so I find out about things that are going on at conferences, articles that are coming out, just people having discussions about certain things that are happening that affect scholarly communications and academic libraries and libraries in general. And I think it can be a really valuable tool, even if you're not posting yourself, to follow some people and see what they're talking about and see what conversations are happening. Finding the hashtags on Twitter for things such for conferences and webinars can be a great way to find people to follow and to see reactions to things that are happening at conferences. Another thing that is really great and I really encourage people to go and check out are the Critlib, hashtag Critlib, critical librarian discussions that happen on Twitter frequently. So you can go to critlib.org, which is critlib.org, and it will tell you about when their chats are happening. And they do them, I think it's weekly. I don't participate in all of them, but I think every week they have a different conversation happening with the hashed Critlib discussion that are moderated by different people. And so that's another great way of finding people to follow is seeing who's moderating these things, seeing who's tweeting in them. And they will have a topic, they will have some resources, so things you might want to read, and a list of questions. And so, you know, they go on for about an hour, but you can always go back and read them later if you can't make it because of time zones and things like that. There's also a lot of really great mailing lists that you can be part of. I think anyone that's listening to this one might be interested in the Library Podcasters mailing list. Google group that I started last summer, and I think both you and Steve are also part of that, and is something where we kind of it's not super active, but there are discussions about library podcaster topics and things like that, and hopefully at some point in the future it will lead to some greater things. And I will mention again some of my Facebook groups that I am part of. There are a lot of Facebook groups for library folks, and some of them are, some of them have more drama than others, I suppose is one way to put it. But some of them are really great as well. And so there are a couple that I will mention are the League of Librarian Gamers, the ALA Games and Gaming Roundtable group. There is the ALA graphic novels and comics in libraries member interest group Facebook group, which is going to have to change their name soon because they're going to become a roundtable very soon. And then there are the ones that I run, and the first of those is the Readers Advisory for Library Staff group, which has I'm so close to 1,000 members. It's really exciting, and so this is just a group where people can talk about Readers Advisory resources that they use. They can ask Readers Advisory questions, and people can give them answers. You can ask for recommendations, all that sort of stuff. And so it's I'm not very good at Readers Advisory, but I thought that this was a space that should exist, and so it's fun to see it there. And then there's the Zine Librarians Facebook group that I created, where, you know, people talk about zine library and stuff. And there's also groups for, you know, my the Book Club for Masochists podcast and the Two Fisted Library Stories zine as well also have their own Facebook groups. And if you're feeling particularly, I don't know, if you really want to follow something specific or two things, you can follow my Two Fisted Library Stories bot, which is at two as in like the numeral, so that like the key on your keyboard, Two Fisted Stories. And so it is a bot that tweets out adventures that people that follow it have. Do you follow that one, Thomas?
I will now.
Okay. Well, then you will start to be appear in adventures with ridiculous things about jammed photocopiers and hideous library cards and overdue items.
And was it, did you just, oh, okay. David Wright must be one of the people in Reader's Advisory for library staff.
I don't know.
That Facebook, I just tried to join on Facebook and it said request to join. And then David approved it. And then a pop-up came up that said, this is a public group. You don't need anyone's approval to join. And I'm like, well, then why did you make me ask?
I think you have to ask, but,
okay.
Anybody can see who's a member is probably the element of it. And then my own personal Twitter account is Midnight Library, MIDNITELIBRARY, if I spelt that correctly. I'm like, did I spell library right? And I'm like, if I didn't spell library right, that's a problem.
You're talking to someone who's Twitter name is Library Tom.
True. I just assume that's how they spelt it in wherever you are from. I don't actually even know that.
Well, the whole telling saga about that is that all the clever portmanteaus of Tom, Thomas, and librarian were taken, so I had to settle for a library.
I spent a long time trying to figure out my Twitter handle. That would be something that I felt would be professional enough, but also my personality enough, because, you know, yeah, all the variations of my name, Matthew, were gone as well, and you're limited by how many characters you could have, so that's why it's Midnight Library instead of Midnight Librarian. I couldn't get that many characters into it. So you can find my website at thematthewmurray.weebly.com, which is themattheweebly.weebly. weebly.com, and that links to the Facebook groups, the zine, the Two-Fisted Library Stories, the podcast. It links to the Reader's Advisory device, the Raspberry Pi thing that we talked about earlier, the Zine Pavilion. It has, you know, some of my publications and stuff are up there too. So if that's probably the easiest way, that's the one-stop shop. If you go that, you can hopefully find everything else. Yeah,
I dare say the show notes for this episode will have more URLs than any other circulating ideas.
I hope I didn't overwhelm you too much with that. I don't know. But I think that's the reason you invited me to be on this podcast is because of the projects and things that I'm involved with.
I feel so relaxed after hearing about all of those.
So, yeah, clearly my dream job is to not have a job and just volunteer and work on projects all the time.
And you just get a grant from some entity or other who says you're doing good work, keep it up.
Yeah, like I really wish that I didn't have to have a job, because there's a second podcast I really want to start, that would be called Lessons I Didn't Learn in Library School, or Things I Didn't Learn in Library School, where I would talk to a different library person on every episode about something that they didn't learn in library school that they found very valuable working in a library, and how they learned it, and how you can learn it, and how they use those skills. And I do not have time to do that, but someday I really hope that is on my list of projects to do.
Well, it'll start with the lesson you talked about earlier, with being able to say no to projects.
Yes.
Which will lead you to be able to say yes to the projects that matter the most.
True. Yeah. That is key, I think, is knowing how to pick the projects that you want to work on. Is an important skill to have within the library world. So thank you for inviting me to be on this podcast, Thomas.
I'm sure that Steve's listeners have been more than happy to get to know you better and are going to explore your many side projects.
I hope that people find them interesting, perhaps become inspired to do their own projects.
And then they'll turn these into conference presentations, and then you're the first hand up during the Q&A portion.
Maybe. Or like, you know, maybe, you know, someone will become inspired to do something, whatever it is, and do it. And then, you know, next year, they'll be the one on this podcast talking to you about their projects.
Yes. Next time Steve gets the flu, I'm putting them in the hot seat. Disclaimer to listeners, Steve is safe and sound. It's all good. Okay, well, good luck to you in all your endeavors, and I look forward to our next conversation.
Great, thanks. Bye, right. Everyone.
Bye.
Circulating Ideas is produced by Steve Thomas in the suburbs of Atlanta with support from listeners like you. Find out how you can help by going to circulatingideas.com and clicking on support. You can also subscribe to the show on Apple Podcasts, Google Play Music, Overcast, or your podcast app of choice. And help others find the show by leaving a rating or review. You can follow the show on Twitter at @CircIdeas or like the show's Facebook page. Music is by Pamela Klicka. Thanks for listening and keep circulating your ideas.